listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Have you noticed that spring has not sprung? By the way, as we move through the program here in our third hour, Steve Keen is going to drop by, the professor of economics, the author of Debunking Economics. And we've got a whole bunch of things that we want to talk about. Is it possible that Cyprus could come to the United States? Might we end up with our banks being closed? What about Mario Draghi, the EU bank, the chief bankster, making a presentation in which he basically shut down the president of France, Francois Hollande, saying, you know, wages are not keeping up with productivity in these deficit countries. Actually, you know, or that they were exceeding productivity, excuse me. Oh, there's this huge gap. You know, the workers are making too much money. It turns out his wage numbers included inflation. His productivity numbers did not. And when you make either one of them, this, you know, apples to apples, pretty much everybody in Europe is doing fine except for Germany. Germany is like, you know, eating everybody's lunch. And guess who's winning in this whole, well, anyhow, we'll get into that in our third hour. In our second hour, Mike Papatoni is going to drop by. And but I wanted to start right out with the climate. I think that this is one of the most important undiscussed issues in the United States, in the world. And it's not discussed in our corporate media for, I think, a fairly simple reason. And that is that our corporate media wants to be able to sell advertising to natural gas companies and coal companies and car manufacturers and, you know, all kinds of groups that have a vested interest in continuing carbon-based fuels. Clean coal, don't you know? Look at this, natural gas well. It just looks like a pipe stuck in the ground with children playing around it. But if you live in the Northeast, you might have noticed it's almost April 1st. In fact, it will be next week, won't it? Monday. Thank you, Shano. And spring really hasn't sprung yet. What's with that? Well, it turns out that there was actually a conference on this. A bunch of scientists got together, held a news conference about this on Tuesday, which, again, probably wasn't reported in your network television or even your local television. And they said that what has happened is that the sea ice at the Arctic has been melting. It's melted so much that in the last three decades, basically since we started pumping out massive amounts worldwide of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, it's really spiked in the last 30 years. That during that period of time, the amount of sea ice in the Arctic has decreased by 80%, and within 7 years, by 2020, it'll all be gone. And it is what's called a positive feedback loop, and that's not a positive thing. That's a negative thing. Negative feedback loops keep things in balance. Positive feedback loops drive things out of control. Here's how it works. Normally, sun hits ice in the Arctic, which is, you know, just a cap over the Arctic Ocean. There's no land up there. There's just a giant ocean. And it's covered with ice. Mountains of ice. And normally, sun hits that, and it's white ice. It reflects in snow, and it reflects that sun back up into the sky. And a certain amount of it escapes through the greenhouse gas layer back out into space and, you know, maintains a certain level of stability of temperature on the planet. The blue water around the ice, blue is darker than white. The sun hits that, and it holds it. It captures the heat. So the more blue to white you have, the ratio of blue to white, the more the area in general just captures heat from the sun every year. And as that ice has decreased by 80%, the amount of blue has increased substantially. It hasn't increased by 80% because the ice is thinning in some places rather than vanishing. So the sun is still seen white. But enough, there has been enough added blue that it's starting to pick up speed, because the more blue there is, the warmer it is, the warmer it is, the more the ice melts, the more the ice melts, the more blue there is, the more blue there is, the more ice, you know, and you got it. Now, what does this have to do with it, you know, summer not coming to Washington, D.C.? Well, there's this thing called the jet stream. And the jet stream pumps weather across the North American continent. It typically flows, you know, kind of across the you know, the Seattle area, over the Rocky Mountains, loops down into the, around the Midwest, and then kind of bounces back up again and pumps back out someplace around Washington, D.C. to Boston. You know, it's like that. And it moves around. It shifts up and down. And it moves a lot of air. And it moves a lot of fairly warm air from the Pacific. The Pacific is the warmest of the two major northern hemisphere oceans. Moves a lot of warm air from the Pacific and from the West Coast over to the East Coast, and it moves weather systems through. The jet stream is caused by the pressure and temperature differential gradient between the Arctic air mass and the air mass below the jet stream, the North American air mass, or the American-Mexican half of the hemisphere air mass. And that gradient is deteriorating as the Arctic gets warmer. So, you know, that contrast in temperatures. And so the jet stream is deteriorating. The jet stream is not moving air through as fast as it used to. It's not moving as much air as it used to. And so the seasons are changing more slowly, oddly enough, or so it appears. This is this news conference that was held on Tuesday. This was right after, by the way, that guy indicted Punxsutawney Phil, the prosecutor. He says, okay, you know, Punxsutawney Phil said spring is coming, and you know, we're gonna charge him with try to get him the death sentence and all this kind of stuff. It was a nice stunt, but everybody gets it. You know, something's going wrong here. And in this article over at ScienceWorldReport.com. by Catherine Griffin. She talks about this. The scientists noted that this phenomenon, what I'm talking about, the Arctic sea ice melting, seems to have slowed the western jet stream. Usually it speeds along quickly in a relatively straight line. The slowing jet stream means that the current can transport less warm air over land in the winter, causing snow and cold to flourish and giving an explanation why we have yet to see spring arrive. And then they say, as the Arctic continues to lose ice, it falls into a self-destructive pattern that causes it to warm even more. Well, I already described that to you. So the weather weirding has just begun. I mean, we're just beginning to see this stuff. And nobody's talking about it. You still have Republican politicians who don't believe in global warming. Oh, sea ice is melted by 80% of the Arctic Sea. Oh, somebody must have made that up. It doesn't say it in the Bible. Right? Show me that in Leviticus. I'll show it to you in Revelation, actually, in chapter 7, you know, where let me describe the end times to you. But, you know, we need that. Poster for the week, by the way. This was over on Democratic Underground a few days ago. The USA should invade the USA and win the hearts and minds of the population by building roads, bridges, and putting locals to work. Hey, what a great idea. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, yeah, Monsanto got their little piece in the budget, the Monsanto protection legislation. It's amazing what you can do if you have money. So welcome back. U.S. corporations, this is amazing. The Washington Post just did an analysis looking at U.S. corporations in the 60s and 70s and today. 22 of the 30 companies in the Dow Jones Industrial Average are paying tax rates that are 10 points lower now than they were 20 and 30 years ago, 40 years ago. 50 years ago, I guess, would be the 60s. And by the way, these federal corporations represent 25 to 50% of worldwide profits, a quarter to a half of all the profits on Earth. And we are taxing them at a 10% lower rate. And meanwhile, what's going on? It's interesting, the Washington Post did this analysis. And meanwhile, what's going on is that the Republicans and the conservatives are running around saying, reduce taxes even more. Corporations shouldn't pay anything in taxes. Right. Mayors Against Illegal Guns coming out. This is Mayor Bloomberg's group pushing members of the Senate. There's, I think, 13. Is it members of the U.S. Senate? Yeah, 13 states. Senators in 13 states have yet to voice their support for new gun control regulations. Many of these Democrats. And Mayor Bloomberg going after them. A new study from First Focus and the Urban Institute. 6.2 million children have at least one unemployed parent. A staggering 12 million kids live in homes with a parent who is underemployed. Unemployment benefits, by the way, on average, the average weekly unemployment benefit nationwide last year was $299. Sequestration just cut that by 10%. Good luck living on that. And it's devastating our kids. It's absolutely devastating our kids. Meanwhile, today was the first day in Greece that Cypriots could go to the bank and say, I'll take my money, please. But... and there's a big but. I mean, this is like, you know, capital B but. But they have this thing called capital controls, and capital controls is a fancy way of saying, no, you can't have all your money. Now, how is it that a bank can say to you, no, you can't have your money? You know, what's the legal basis for this? I thought that if I went to a bank and I put my money in that bank says, oh, this is Tom Hartman's money right here, and if he wants it, he can come and get it. Right? This is the image we all have in our hands, in our heads, of the old Western bank out there, you know, in the old Wild West with a safe, and you know, the bank robbers would come and they'd, you know, blow the safe open and snatch everybody's money, and it would be your money and my money and Ben Shano's money and Jim's money and, you know, Danielle's money. All, you know, it's all there. Piles of money and, you know, and it ain't that way. Actually, the way it works is that when you go to the bank and say, okay, here's my paycheck, please deposit it, the bank says, thank you very much, and they give you not a receipt for your money, but an IOU. You, if you look at the balance sheet of a bank, you will discover that you are now a lender to the bank. They are a creditor to you. You are a debtor to you. You are a creditor to the bank. You are a lender to the bank. They are a borrower from you. And so what they do is they give you a receipt for the money that you have loaned them. And that you arguably have a claim to, but it's now, you know, their money. And as, you know, I mean, people declare bankruptcy all the time. The money just never gets paid back. And if the bank decides that they're not going to pay you back, I mean, you can go to court, you can try and get it, all that kind of stuff, but, you know, it's not really your money. What you have is an IOU from the bank, and if the bank isn't worth as much as your money, or if the bank doesn't have your money, good luck. Now, we do have deposit insurance in the United States, but they had a deposit insurance in Cyprus. There are ways around it, it turns out. And so... we're going to get into that, as I said, in the third hour in some greater detail, but I just wanted to point out that this is these strict capital controls. They're saying to the people of Cyprus, you can take up to $300 or 300 euros, about $400. You take up to 300 euros per day out of the bank. That's it. And there's a limit on credit card withdrawals, and there's a limit on large purchases and a limit on transfers into and out of the country. And presumably you can put all the money you want into the bank. I would be very surprised if anybody was saying, oh, wait a minute, we can't do that. So these are and credit card transactions. Oh, and local businesses have to limit their transactions to a maximum of 5,000 euros a day. Now, that would be the money that they're taking out of the bank, presumably to buy things like merchandise for their shelves. This is, you know, really quite remarkable. And then you put this on top of this presentation, and this was exposed by the Guardian newspaper in the UK yesterday. This presentation that was done a month or so ago, a while back, I'll have to dig the article out and get the exact date. There's also a link to it on Raw Story as well as theguardian.co.uk, where, you know, the president of France, François Hollande, is there saying, you know, we need to be stimulating the economies of Europe. Because if we don't do some government spending and get our economies going, you know, our workers are going to be screwed, and they're driving the economic train. And Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, does this little PowerPoint presentation in which he shows, no, sorry, France, you're actually, over the last 12 years, you've been paying your workers more than their productivity. Turns out, you lied.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As mentioned earlier, they were calculating one with inflation and the other without, and France actually is right in the range where it should be, but Hollande got shot up in austerity hat. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The USA. Remember this? Remember all this? We had this conversation over and over and over again. I would have this with neocons back when we were talking about the Iraq War, back, you know, 6-8 years ago. Well, you know, we're gonna help them rebuild their country. We're gonna capture their hearts and minds. We're gonna build schools and roads. And you say that, and all the Republicans and all the neocons, they nod their head and they go, yeah, cool, build schools, build roads, yeah, bridges, yeah, put people back to work, yeah, Iraq, yeah, Afghanistan, yeah, New York, no, not so much. Mississippi, are you crazy? Texas, no. We don't need no stinking infrastructure. Let America turn itself into a third world country. The USA should invade the USA and win the hearts and minds of the population by building roads, bridges, and putting locals to work. Remarkable. Tim in Sycamore, Illinois, you had a question about Thomas Jefferson.
Hi, Tom. Nice. I love your show.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to WCVT.
A while back, I'm not even looking for it, I found a quote that had Tom Jefferson saying that the country deserved a revolution of the mind of the Constitution, you know, every 20 years or so, and I just sort of forgot about it. And then I've been looking for it again, and I haven't been able to find it. I know that you're good with the history of the constitutional founding fathers, and I just thought, well, maybe you might have an answer for me.
Yeah. He did say something to that effect, and in fact, he was talking about how each generation, in order, if you were going, this was, first of all, this was something that he said long before he was president. Thomas Jefferson, you can usually find arguments for both sides of pretty much anything you want to argue,
right,
you know, with Jefferson quotes, because he went from being a revolutionary to being the president, you know, the head of the institution of government.
Yeah.
And so he's been on, you know, you can find quotes on both sides of every institution. But in any case, the point, he made a couple of points. He said, you would no more expect the next generation to live by the rules of their parents' generation. And I'm paraphrasing wildly here. It's been a decade since I've read the quote. But then you would expect a man to wear the same clothes he wore as a child. And, you know, if you Google around, look around for Jefferson quotes that involve clothes, that'll probably pop up. And that was in that same letter, that same little piece there. He defined a generation as being 19 years. I think this was a letter to Madison, as I recall, but I might be wrong. And he suggested that, the Constitution should be, more of a living document, less resistant to change. And these were comments that he made before the French Revolution as well. In fact, in the years, the year or so leading up to it, in the first few months of the French Revolution, Jefferson said a number of things that are quoted today by Tea Partiers, like, you know, the Tree of Liberty needs to be watered periodically by the blood of patriots. And right. Something that he lived to regret saying, because, you know, he had seen his own, you know, the bloody revolutionary war in his own country. And he thought the revolution in France was going to go the same way. It's, you know, and so did Thomas Paine. You know, a lot of these guys thought that. Paine went over to France to join up. And when he got there, Maximilien Robespierre had taken over the whatever the French group was called, the cabinet. No, there's a funny word for it, whatever. And Robespierre, I mean, they'd gotten the guillotine out, and he was starting to kill, you know, not just executing the French royalty. He was going after anybody who just didn't want to dance to his tune. They had changed the names of the days of the week and the months of the year, and they had outlawed Christianity, and they'd done all of this stuff. And, you know, by the time Paine got there, Paine was going, hey, you guys, maybe you've gone a little too far. And they said, okay, that's it. And they threw him in prison. And James Monroe had to smuggle a bunch of money into the country,
right,
on behalf of James Madison, who was doing it at the behest of Jefferson to get Tom Paine out of the country. And then when he came back to the United States after they got him out of prison, he was at that point his book The Rights of Man is the one he wrote in response to Sir Edmund Burke. It was his book about his anti-religion book. And I'm forgetting the title of it right now, but he wrote a book basically in praise of atheism and pointing out that religion is not a good thing and all this kind of stuff. And it had been widely read in the United States, and there was this religious revival going on in America at the time. And he was so disliked that when he died, there was only 7 people who showed up at his funeral, and for a long time he had an unmarked grave in New York. And it was actually Thomas Edison who brought him back. But I have wandered way off course here. Yes, Jefferson did say words to that effect. Have I answered your question, Tim?
To that effect,
yeah,
it does. And you're pretty sure that it was something prior to his presidency.
I believe so. I could be wrong, but I believe so.
Oh,
you know, he would pontificate at various times in his life.
Right, right. And I generally don't like to use Thomas Jefferson quotes, you know, because, you know, the writer of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence.
Well, he didn't write the Constitution. He wrote the Declaration. He was in France when the Constitution was written.
And he still held slaves, and I just thought that's kind of hypocritical to claim freedom for Americans and yet have slaves.
Yeah. Yeah, if you Google my name and Jefferson's name and slavery, you'll find a couple of pieces that I wrote. He spent much of his political life trying to end slavery. It was the first piece of legislation that he introduced when he was in his 20s in the House of Burgesses in Virginia. Nearly cost him his political career. And,
right.
You know, he was one of those people who was born into the institution of slavery. In other words, born with slaves, inherited slaves. His wife brought slaves to the marriage. He lived off slaves. He profited from slavery. There is no way to justify that and no way to rationalize it. And at the same time, he was trying to unwind the institution. I mean, you know, it had been an institution for several hundred years at that point in this country. And
yeah.
So there's, you know, like I said, there's no way that you can pardon any of these guys who own slaves. And at the same time, some of them were a little more enlightened in trying to change the course of history than others. But Jefferson was still a slave master or a slave owner. And you cannot get away from that. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up? You say
I was just marveling at your misinformation about the the rumor of global warming. There's no credible scientific evidence that exists that can validate that entire debunked theory.
Well, you know, as far as I can tell, Steve, there's no evidence that the world is not flat.
Okay.
Have you looked out your window?
Yeah, well, actually, I've been around enough of the world to know that it's not flat.
And really? So, how do you know?
When I look out my window, I see your studio, so there you go.
Yeah, so, you know, the world is flat.
Well,
world is flat. Global warming's not happening.
Since I can see 800, but the best.
Steve, I assume you're joking.
Greenland, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm assuming that you're joking, that you're just calling to be to try to play a provocateur or village clown or something.
No, I hang out with people like Dennis Avery and Roy Spencer. Fred Singer, these are.
You hang out with Fred Singer?
Scientists.
You know, Fred Singer used to take money from the tobacco industry and insist that tobacco didn't cause cancer.
I don't know about that. That's
yeah,
really
and then, you know, when that business went away, then he started taking money from the fossil fuel industry and saying that, you know, fossil fuels don't cause global warming. Yeah, are you seriously want to listen to Fred Singer, Steve? Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, good luck. Sanchez in Long Beach, California. Hey, Sanchez.
Senor Hartman, good day to you as usual.
And thank you.
Wanted to ask a couple of questions here, if I have time, about the farmer assurance provision, that Monsanto Protection Act that our president signed a few nights ago.
It wasn't a standalone piece of legislation. It was attached to the let's continue funding the government for another few months stuff.
Yes, that was actually my first question, because it was attached as a rider to this and submitted anonymously. So my first issue or concern is the issue of transparency. Isn't there supposed to be some name attached to this when it's going through Congress?
No, Congress has the ability to anonymously attach things, or it wouldn't be there anonymously attached. I would say that the biggest issue here is, why has the media not reported this?
Right.
Why has there been no discussion of this whatsoever? Well, and let me answer that semi-rhetorical question with an actual answer, and that is because Monsanto is a very, very large transnational corporation, and so is our media.
Mm-hmm.
And
working hand in hand on this one.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to step on their own feet. Or the feet of their friends.
Just to drop in as well, that there's several key personnel working in the Obama administration, including Michael Taylor, who used to be one of the Monsanto executives.
The Obama administration, just like every other administration, Democratic and Republican, is filled with banksters in the banking areas, Monsantoers in the seed areas. Yeah. I mean, welcome to the wonderful world of America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Excuse me, I should say, you know, post Supreme Court money is speech America. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Are you kidding? Jennifer in Berkeley, California, you had a comment about gay marriage.
Yes. One argument that chaps my hide that I never hear anybody make the argument against is when they always bring up children. This crap about, you know, if you argue with somebody against gay marriage, it finally gets down to, well, that's what is the traditional thing has to be that way because of the production of children.
Right.
And marriage has not been about child production for a century at least. And my immediate family is very small, okay, but my older sister wanted to have children since she was a child. That's what she fantasized about. She wanted to have 10 of them. By the time she was an adult, she had a disability that rendered her very unfortunately sterile. Should there be a law prohibiting her to have ever gotten married?
Right.
I never wanted to have children since the time I was a child, and I never changed my mind. Should there have been a law against me from the time I was 8 years old that I never should have been allowed to be married?
Right.
My parents got divorced. They then realized that, you know, after many years of therapy, they figured out how to live together. They re-cohabitated, and after 30 years of living together in sin, they got remarried. But that wasn't until they were in their 70s and they'd already been parents, and very good parents, and it didn't affect the way that they were parents. Mm-hmm. Should they have been prohibited from getting remarried?
Yeah.
None of these things are the law. And in fact, the weddings that I have been to, people write their own vows. The definition of marriage in this day and age is exactly what the two people getting married define it to be.
Yes. Brilliantly said, Jennifer. Brilliantly said. And in fact, Justice Anthony Kennedy, I think, when he was asking about the status of the children in California, Shane, you've got that. Do you have that clip from that was not from yesterday, but from the day before yesterday? He actually pointed out that in the state of California, there are, if you want to talk about children, there are children who are the children within families where the parents are a gay couple, and those kids would like their parents to be married. You know, here's the guy who's probably going to be the swing vote on both of these issues, speaking about this day before yesterday.
On the other hand, there is an immediate legal injury or legal, what could be a legal injury, and that's the voice of these children. There are some 40,000 children in California, according to the Red Brief, that live with same-sex parents. And they want their parents to have full recognition and full status.
There you go. The guy that, you know, I never thought that would be coming out of Kennedy, but it did. So, Jennifer, thank you for the call. Excellent point, and much appreciated your calling and making it. Pete in Tyler, Texas. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I got two things. One, very quickly, I'd like a little sympathy by Senator Cronin and Cruz, and my congressman is Louis Gohmert.
Oh, man. You talk about living behind enemy lines.
I got an email this morning, which had a
occupied territory
video, which was basically that the guy was trying to sell subscriptions to his economic financial newsletter, but right. He agreed with you. You've been talking about the probability of a big crash in between now and 2015.
Yeah, or 2016.
And he is saying the same thing, except that because with your prediction, I just took it for granted that having cash in the bank would be a good thing to have, because when the stock market crashed, you could buy back in at a very low prices. He is talking about that the crash that he's predicting a crash also, but the crash that he's predicting is coming in the form of an attack by China and various other governments on the American dollar, so that it won't be the coin of international commerce.
Right.
And once we lose that status of being the coin of the realm, so to speak, our dollar is going to go into hyperinflation.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about your take on those two sides of the
That's a great question. And in fact, Shane and Jim, if you guys can help me try to remember an hour and a half from now when we've got Steve Keen on the line, I'd like to ask him his take on that, because he's actually got a PhD in economics and teaches it full time. My take on it, though, as an informed layman, not as an economist, is that inflation is not caused or prevented by a particular currency being the currency in which oil is denominated around the world, which is how dollar is the dollar by and large is the medium of international exchange. And the euro is increasingly, you know, starting to fill that role. But everything, oil prices always go back to dollars. If oil was no longer denominated in dollars, you may see the price of oil go up relative to the dollar, which would mean that you could argue that at least if you're looking at oil, you've got inflation, and oil affects pretty much everything else. I mean, our food is made out of oil, basically. It's transported with oil. It's grown with oil, oil pesticides, oil fertilizers, oil, you know, on and on it goes. Our electricity, so many things come from oil, mostly transportation, though. But that wouldn't mean hyperinflation. That would just be the inflation like we had in the 70s, which was the result of the price of oil going up really quickly, a price shock. And that is always, my understanding of how inflation works is that inflation is always caused by there being a shortage of a commodity. In fact, the last time we were talking, I've talked to Stephanie Kelton and Steve Keen about this, two economists, And both of them have said that there are no examples of, you know, where currencies have been inflated by just printing extra dollars. It's always been the printing of the dollars is chasing the shortage of goods or services. So, you know, in Zimbabwe, it was the shortage of food. In the United States, it was the shortage of oil. And, you know, they drove up the price of oil. The Arabs cut off our oil. And these are the things that you see. Whether that's going to be the nature of the crash, I don't know. I think that the biggest concern that we have is how internationally interlocked we are with the rest of the world. Because I see this as a crash going worldwide. I see a Chinese housing bubble and giant infrastructure building out China bubble bursting, and a huge credit bubble in China right now bursting. I see an $800 trillion unsecured gray market in collateralized debt obligations and things here in the United States, worldwide, see that crashing. And I see the Eurozone going down in flames, the Euro. And I think all of that is going to conspire to be a real mess. Thanks, Pete.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio on the line with us from down Florida way. Mike Papantonio, the attorney and the host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. And Pap, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. It's nice to see you. There's a lot going on in the world today. But one of the things that really troubles me, I don't know if you saw this report that Li Fang, spelled like Fang, but he pronounces it Fang, wrote for The Nation about all this corporate media infrastructure, the right-wing media infrastructure that's being built out. They've got these so-called reporters in every state capital
and
feeding stories to local media. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thought is that it's again a story about the progressive movement not being a movement, to the sense that I think now it's about 15 years ago, a handful of progressives that tried to launch Air America Radio and actually make it into something was a progressive infrastructure, went to leadership organization after leadership organization, whether it was MoveOn.org, whether it was Democracy Alliance, and said, look, we have to answer what's happening with the right-wing media build-out. And there's this, unfortunately, progressives have a bad element to their DNA a lot of times. And that bad element is, if it's not my idea, it's not important. And I remember being in a room with several of those meetings, face to face, saying, look, here's the problem. You can have all the great ideas you want. You can try to push back as much as you want. But if you don't have an infrastructure and a vehicle to do it, then all you're doing is wasting time. So this is another example. When we were telling them that Rush Limbaugh, yes, Rush Limbaugh is a threat, the movement of Fox News is a threat, that we have to capture big ideas by way of a media infrastructure. Again, it was the leadership, time and time again, that came directly from the Democratic Party most of the time, that simply says, well, you know, that's not our idea, so it seems unimportant. So, you know, we find ourselves exactly where I would have predicted.
Yeah. And I think that there's a certain element, though, here, kind of an organic element to this, Mike Papantonio, that the... If you're a Koch brothers, if you're a billionaire, if you're a guy who is, you know, obsessed with making more and more and more money and having more and more and more political power, and you invest in building out a local think tank in every state capital in the United States, all 50 of them, and hiring at least two quote reporters in every one of those state capitals. And having them feed stories to the local media because the local media has got all these cutbacks and things. We're talking chump change here. We're talking a couple, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
You know, this is money that, this is the, you know, the amount of cash that Charles and David Koch probably make in about 35 minutes.
Mm.
And yet, it has the ability to change the dialogue in the United States, and it will do so in a way that increases their profits. Now, if you go to progressives, if you go to progressive wealthy progressives and say, you know, it's going to make a better country, they go, yeah, and there's a lot of other things that make a better country too. Let's vaccinate everybody. Let's do something about housing.
Right.
Let's do something about, you know. Whereas the billionaires are singularly focused on basically the tax code.
That's exactly right. We're not a movement. You see, they're a movement, Tom. We're such a disconnected cadre of individuals. For example, you know, the DOMA group, they might focus singularly on the DOMA issue, and they might ignore the union movement. The environmentalists might focus singularly on their elements and ignore the women's movement. The civil justice process, all progressives ignore that for the most part. But on the other side, you have a well-disciplined group. Now, they may appear dysfunctional. They may be scattered in their methodology for getting their message out there. But ultimately, their message is the same. The anti-abortion right types toe the line for the free market capitalists. The gun rights advocates toe the line for the anti-immigrant zealots because they think of themselves as a movement. They aren't always asking, what is in it for my unique little group? I got to tell you, I've been in the progressive movement my entire adult life. And the biggest problem, the biggest flaw that will kill the progressive movement is they don't think like that. They think, what is in it for my movement? For you know, you have a movement with the right wing that, look, we can define it as prejudice, anti-intellectualism, nativism, class and race elitism, but they're on board for that ugly movement. The NRA funds the same think tanks that the anti-union advocates fund. We don't have that, and we never have. Because we think we're so damn smart as progressives that it's only our idea that matters, and to hell with everybody else. And it's going to destroy this movement.
I don't disagree with the arc of your logic, but it seems to me that it's not so much that the environmentalists are saying, you know, I'm not going to get into line behind, you know, somebody whose big issue is the women's right to choose to have an abortion or not, or even have birth control or not. It's not that they're saying, you know, we're not part of a movement. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is. I wouldn't characterize it in a negative way. I would characterize it as, you know, we've got these silos. We've got to figure out a way to have everybody realize that they're
Tom, the problem, and I simply disagree with you on this. I see it as I don't know whether it's in our DNA or what, but I have watched it my entire adult life as a progressive.
Yeah.
I watched it with the media issue. Right now, for example, you have this incredible vehicle right here, Free Speech TV. If you were to go around the country and find out, well, who backs Free Speech TV? Who backs this rare infrastructure? Who does that? Well, there's no plan. There's no consolidation of effort. There's no consolidation of money.
There's no billionaires. It's mostly, you know, the people who do the pledge drives.
Yeah, that's basically
it's
it.
The viewers.
And whether it's progressive radio, whether it is a progressive, there is no movement, Tom, and that's hard for us to accept.
So how do we fix that, Pat?
Well, first of all, is the recognition that it exists. That's the first thing. And then second of all, I think to be able to say to these people that believe that they're always right, there was nothing more agonizing for me, whether it was practicing law at the level I practice law, I negotiate with the biggest organizations in the world, not just in America. But I never felt the frustration as much as I did when I went around trying to negotiate with people who had the money to help with a progressive effort.
Yeah.
And it would always land, Tom, on it's not my idea, so hell with it. Yeah. I really promise.
About
I hate
being Air America. I wonder, Pap, if it might be. I mean, I've had this conversation with John Dean, who wrote Conservatives Without Conscience, you know, Richard Nixon's guy.
Yeah.
And he said that conservatives are genetically or however they're wired, they will salute the flag. They are followers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't mind having a leadership. In fact, they're more comfortable when there's a leadership. Progressives, on the other hand, are people who think that we should all have relatively equal power. We should have a more egalitarian society. And they get very nervous when somebody says, I'm in charge. And if any group, if Greenpeace were to come out and say, we're going to organize a movement for everybody. Hey, you women's rights movement folks, come on over. Hey, you, you know, anti-GMO folks, come on over. Everybody's going to go, Greenpeace? I don't think so. You know, and it's like, because we just, I think progressives don't like the idea of centralized leadership.
Well, it's unfortunate. I think you're right, but I think ultimately the demise of the progressive movement if we don't get it under control.
Yeah. Well, we've got to find, I think increasingly we're finding our voices, certainly on the internet and in the progressive media structure that we've been building out that uses the internet as well as traditional radio, television, podcasts, and everything else. And Ring of Fire Radio is an important part of it. RingofFireRadio.com. Mike Papantonio, thanks for being with us,
Pat. Thank you, Tom.
Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Be sure to check out RingofFireRadio.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And... Well, this is interesting. Kirby in Naples, Idaho. Did you find my Jefferson quote that I was wandering off about? Or are you trying to find one? Kirby? No Kirby. Okay. Well, let's see what Ray in Bedford, Pennsylvania has to say. Hey, Ray.
Hey.
How you doing?
Yes. I'm about your age. I'm a veteran of the Vietnam era. You have a lot of good coverage. I learn something almost every day that I watch your show.
Thank you.
My beef is there's something wrong with this government.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason. I mean,
it's money. What's wrong with it. What's wrong with it is money. Money has contaminated our political process. And it began largely after the Civil War, when the railroad barons came in and started buying members of Congress and buying Supreme Court justices, and their purchasing of the Supreme Court justices, particularly a guy by the name of Stephen J. Field, who was on the Supreme Court in the 1880s. It was outright owned by the railroads. We found in the National Archives letters from the railroad barons to him saying that they would run him for president in the elections of 1888 and 1892 if he would just, you know, do their bidding and get persons or corporations. And at that time in America, the largest corporations were the big five railroads. If they would just get them to get constitutional rights, and Field did that. He ruled that six or seven different times on the Ninth Circuit Court. And then he was also on the Supreme Court, and he brought those cases with him. They were called the California tax cases, the railroad tax cases, to the Supreme Court over and over and over again. And finally got his collaborator, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, who was the clerk of the court, to write a head note to the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case in 1886, saying that, you know, corporations are persons. Of course they're persons. The head note had no legal standing, but the railroads got what they wanted, and they were able then to begin this doctrine of corporations as persons and money as speech that has turned into this monster that we call Citizens United. And that was not the precise moment, but that was the high watermark of the corruption of the American system of governance. And the progressive movement a generation later in the 1890s through the 19-teens was the backlash to that. And then the backlash to the progressive movement was the right-wing movement that brought Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover in as president in the 1920s. And then they crashed the economy, as they always do. And then the backlash to that was the New Deal, and then the Reaganomics was the backlash to the New Deal. And now we're in the middle of this battle of, are we going to have Reaganomics and keep going in that direction, move closer and closer and closer to America the way it was during the Gilded Age, when the robber barons ran this country and government had very little power, very small government, very little power, and the billionaires owned everything. And during the 1920s, when, again, you know, government did very little, taxes were very low, are we going to go back to that and, you know, continue with the Reagan Revolution, or are we going to end the experiment of the Reagan Revolution and go back to the New Deal and go back to go back to a progressive vision of America? And I don't know the answer to that. My personal opinion is that we're going to have a god-awful crash, and that out of that crash is going to come a transformation of America into another New Deal, that it's going to be even better than the New Deal was, that we're going to realize Roosevelt's four freedoms, not just his four freedoms, his second Bill of Rights, and America is going to emerge out of this as a country that looks much more like the northern European countries, because they've been through everything. You know, they've been to hell and back. They've been through World War II and everything else, and demonstrated that form of democratic socialism, and I know you're not supposed to say those words on the air in America, but hey, I'll say it, is actually a very, very stable, highly functional system of governance that works. It works for the people. It works for the billionaires. It works for the government. It works for everybody. But I think that there is a small possibility that the right wingers who are building their infrastructure, they've got a new video out now. There's an article, the Alternate has a piece, you can watch it. The Tea Party Patriots, where they're at the very end, the guy is holding the flame. He's holding a torch up, and it so reminds me of the Nuremberg rallies in 1938 in Nuremberg, Germany. You know, where the Nazis were holding the torch up, you know, holding the torches up, these night torchlight, you know, and the echo of that, of course, the KKK. And it's like, you know, the right wingers are working really, really hard to build out their infrastructure and be there when the crash happens so that they can take over. But I think that an aroused and awakened citizenry is, you know, going to work more to the benefit of a progressive America.
Well, I'll tell you, Tom, from watching your show, I've learned a lot from you. And there's some other subjects that I'd like for you to talk about. One would be spend some time on this Homeland Security Act.
Yeah.
With all its details.
Yeah.
And also on Monsanto. I mean, you know, we're all worried about the guns, but I think we ought to start worrying about the food.
Yeah, I'm with you. And Ray, thank you for the suggestions. I'm going to move along. We got a bunch of callers here, and it's not fair not to bring other people in, but it's, you know, excellent point. Bill in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, Bill, what's up? Bill? It is a problem. People have been on hold for, Bill's been on hold for 42 minutes, and I think anyhow, we're just 30 seconds away from the break, so I'm not going to put somebody else on and only give them 30 seconds. But I will continue your calls when we come back. But the earlier caller's point that, you know, hey, let's talk about Monsanto more. I should, and we will. We need to track down an expert on what's going on. How did this Monsanto thing even get into the budget bill? You know, how did that happen? And, you know, I mean, I can summarize the process very simply. Somebody got bought off, and there's enough other people who are beholden to Monsanto or unwilling to face a primary challenge from somebody sponsored by Monsanto or some other company. And as Mike Papantonio pointed out, these guys work hand in glove with each other. So, you know, maybe they're unwilling to, you know, work with somebody who's a primary challenge that's being sponsored by some other large corporation or some other, you know, right-wing think tank. But they're all on that team. And, you know, we got to build our team. The problem is, you know, from what central base? That's a tough one. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Program. We will be back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
One of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of the Tom Hartman Reader, sent out courtesy of stamps.com. So, welcome back. Eamon is at the top of the hour. Is that right? Danielle came over and told me about that. Okay, great. Super. Eamon Fingleton is actually going to be with us, and a writer about economics with Forbes magazine. I want to get into a conversation with somebody who's really knowledgeable about this stuff, about what's going on in Cyprus, what it might mean for us. And, you know, we'll continue that conversation. Meanwhile, Jill in Abingdon, Maryland, do I have that right? Great. Hey, Jill, you had some thoughts on right versus left, people wanting leadership or not?
What I was going to say is, you know, you were talking about how the left wing is scattered and kind of like wedded to issues, and then the right wing's real unified.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a problem that I see that's underneath that. The right wing had this idea that they're on the inside, you know, and they can control events and stuff, and people want to join that, and also people that tend to like authoritarians over them are scared people or people with a psychological predisposition to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also the liberal side, which is more uncomfortable with authoritarianism and don't trust it. But then also liberals or, you know, progressives, they get their issues, but the right wing is throwing all these issues at us at the same time, these problems, one after another. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, on top of that, we have to try to get these issues solved, so many issues at once, but we don't have enough trust in each other because of the experience with authoritarians in our lives and our psychological dispositions to unite enough to fight these issues as one. We don't understand to go to the head and take it down. We're concerned about everything, and it's so much it overwhelms the progressives, so they can't really go on. And at the same time, they don't trust each other.
Yeah.
Enough.
I wonder if there might be some. See, I suspect that that's happening in the Tea Party as well, in the grassroots movement on the right, that there are people who are worried that they're being infiltrated or that they're being co-opted or whatever.
Well, it's not so much infiltration with the left. It's more like overwhelmed, too many issues, and then it's like not enough trust in, say, an authority figure. Like they always ask, well, who made you God to try to say this goes first?
Right.
And they'll
right.
be like frustrated.
See,
they don't trust each other enough to say that all issues will get taken care of once the big issues taken care of. They don't have that kind of.
I think on the right, underneath virtually everything is the issue of ultimately this will make money. And,
exactly. And people still believe in money.
Yeah.
They believe money means something. As long as they believe a piece of paper is worth anything, this game will continue.
Which is going to be forever. So, and that's I think one of the major powers that they have. Jill, thank you for weighing in on that. Thanks for the call. Daniel, in Henderson, Nevada, you had some thoughts on the progressive base.
Yes, Tom, I did, actually. I know we're scattered as a progressive unit, and I had an idea that, I know that a lot of the right seems to be pretty fanatic about church, and the progressives seem to be falling away from that. Now, I'm agnostic myself, but if we had that same motivation just to show up once a week together and put together our ideas, I think that could be huge for us.
Yeah, there are some great groups that come out of getting together once a week, typically on Sundays. The Unitarian Universalist Association, which is not a religious body but kind of behaves like one. The Quakers, which are sort of a little closer to being a religious body and behaves like one. Are very, very, active, progressive activists and great organizations. So, there's some possibilities there. I continue to believe, and thank you for the call, Dane. I continue to believe, though, that when Will Rogers said, I am not, and then this was 100 years ago, he said, I am not a member of an organized political party. I am a Democrat. And that has always been the problem of people of progressives and people on the left is that they don't, people on the left tend to distrust authority figures, authoritarian figures. And so if somebody comes along and says, hey, I'm going to pull everybody together under my umbrella because I've got a couple $1 billion so I can do it. The way that it's being done on the right, or the way that it's been done on the right by a fairly small number of people and groups. People on the left would go, oh, wait a minute, and then you get these internecine warfare. Oh, you don't talk about the environment enough, or you're not diverse enough, or you're not this or that. Yeah, and the result is that the organizations get paralyzed, things don't get done, and whether Papantonio is right that we just think we're too damn smart, or whether I'm right that I think that people, progressives in general, are just hardwired not to. Trust authority. That's the number one thing that I remember from my teenage years is never trust anybody over 30. Don't trust authority. And here I am over 30. But we'll see where it goes. I think that this is why the FDR era was the golden era, because FDR came along and said, I'll do it all. Right. We had the Dust Bowl going on. He's like, we're going to put people to work to plant trees. And it ended the Dust Bowl. Because the Dust Bowl was the result of bad agricultural practices and the clearing of way too much land out there. He says, we're going to plant trees. We're going to stop the Dust Bowl. So he's, we're going to do the environment. We're going to do economics. We're going to help the elderly. We're going to integrate America. We're going to help minorities. We're going to, you know, be pro-diversity. I mean, none of this happened with lightning speed, and yet all of it happened at lightning speed. If you look at where we were in 1932 as a nation, women had only been able to vote for 12 years at that point, for example. And it's just, you know, he was willing to stand up and say, I will be the leader. And Americans, progressive Americans, were willing to say, okay, you be the leader and we will follow. We will push you both. In part because of the crisis of the Republican Great Depression. And I continue to think that that's what it's going to take again. It's going to take another Republican Great Depression to bring forward another FDR-like figure. And you may ridicule me or be horrified by my saying this, one or the other, or applaud it. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if in 2016, the Obama administration is trying, just like the Bush administration in 2008 was, trying to hold back that tsunami of economic crash, which is coming because of all of these, you know, all of the Reagan Revolution kicked all the props out underneath the economy. It's like the carnival roller coaster, you know, somebody went around and every other 2x4 that's holding the thing up, they knocked it out. Right? And it's only got half its base. And the roller coaster is still going around. It's starting to swing wilder and wilder and wilder. And in 2016, as we're going into the election, the Obama administration is trying to hold that, keep that from falling apart and, you know, shattering, just like the Bush administration was in 2008. And they're not able to do it. And the economy crashes in 2016. And the next FDR is President Hillary Clinton. Would not surprise me at all. And I think she has the ability to be that and to do that. And I realize all the baggage that the Clintons bring with it and everything else. But, you know, FDR had a lot of baggage, too. And he was a rich guy from New York State, and et cetera, et cetera. We will see. I'm just, you know, thinking out loud here. Probably not a good idea. Max in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Max, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to talk to you and your listeners about the idea. You probably know about it. In Europe, there's a quite growing movement, especially in Germany, about the unconditional basic income.
Yes.
And I just wanted to make you aware of that. I think that that could be really a topic that for the progressive movement to gather around, you know, because
Thomas,
it does. Pardon me?
Thomas Paine, back
exactly.
in 1790 something, in mid 1790s, wrote a booklet. It's about 40, 50 pages long, called Agrarian Justice. And in that, he laid out what we call today Social Security, what we call unemployment insurance. He laid out a whole bunch of things that became the New Deal. But one of the things that he laid out was that every person, when they're born, the government will create an account for them, basically a checking account, and seed it with a certain amount of money, and that when they become 21, that they will start to accrue the interest from that account to them, never the principal, and therefore they will always have a minimum standard of living, that everybody would have a minimum standard of living in the United States, and that any employer must pay a minimum wage, another one of Thomas Paine's suggestion from his book Agrarian Justice. And I'm familiar with that, Max, but not in an enormous amount of detail. For somebody who,
there is a website just launched recently. It's called basicincome2013.eu, and there's also a good new video on YouTube. It's titled "Basic Income: A New Human Right."
And basic income. Okay, I will check that out. Thanks for the tip on that, Max. And I just wrote it down, and I'm going to check it out. And if I can find anybody to come on and talk about it, we will do that. Thank you very much for the call. I do appreciate it. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
A basic income. I mean, this is the minimum wage. And shouldn't we just, at the very least in America, start with a minimum wage of $10 or $12 an hour? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And time for the Talk Radio News Service. Our report with Ellen Ratner, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of the goat and the person you helped at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Tom. Well, okay. Today, the president signed an executive order on election reform, and everybody's all excited about that because it's very bipartisan. Bob Bauer from the Dems and Ben Ginsburg from the Republican, but
Ben Ginsburg, I remember him as a right-wing crazy that I debated on the radio like 5 or 6 years ago.
He probably did. Remember Swift Boats?
Yeah.
That was Ben Ginsburg.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And the president just put him on a commission. Well, he's got to find some Republican someplace.
That's right. So
maybe getting a crazy Republican is like a really smart thing. Maybe not. I don't. Well, we'll just have to see how this plays out.
Well,
so this commission is supposed to look at for example, why people in African-American neighborhoods are waiting in line 10 hours to vote, whereas people in white suburbs.
The great state of Ohio being a perfect example.
Yeah. So.
Why do people in Cuyahoga County have longer waits than people elsewhere?
See, I think instead of a bipartisan commission, I think bipartisanship is way too overvalued, especially by this White House. I think it should have been a nonpartisan commission. And what he should have done was go to the EEOC or the FEOC, the Federal Election Commission.
Commission, yep.
FEC. And found two or three good bureaucrats who've been doing their job through four or five administrations who don't care that much about politics, but really are just
it's
total
like
nerds
about
elections.
It's like I think they ought to put
elections.
All together all the old members of Congress and have them, who have retired at least 5 years, and have them sort of run Congress for a while.
Yeah. The ones who have not become lobbyists.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, right.
Yeah. The few.
The Connie Morellas of the world.
Yeah. And the Bob Nays.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Well, you know, in their wisdom, I mean, this may be a very smart move by the president. We don't know. Maybe he's trying to do an end run around the Republican Party. But I'm one of the few people, and I think I even said this to you last night, off air, that believes that Rahm Emanuel was kind of nicely pushed to be mayor of Chicago. Well, you know now, he's under a lot of trouble from the teachers union. He said that it's settled now. The teachers union is not very happy campers about the fact that he's closing something like 50 schools in inner city Chicago, mainly in African American areas. Mm-hmm. He's being accused of some real racism. I think the president, in his wisdom, found a nice little place for him, except
so
that now the people of Chicago are suffering.
So you think that Rahm Emanuel was basically pushed out of the White House?
I do, actually. And at the time he did that, I went down to the bottom of the press room and I said, this guy's being pushed out. And everybody thought I was crazy. I said, well, let's just wait 10 years when the books come out, and I bet you I'm right.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. Well, he's you know, I disagree with what he's doing with the schools in Chicago. But I will give him credit that he's an active mayor.
He's a very active mayor.
And so it's not like, you know, the Coolidge presidency. I mean, he's not just like, you know, warming the seat.
Poor old Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah, really.
Okay. Some other things going on today. The president today made he gave a talk today in the East Room on the 100th day of Hurricane Sandy. Sandy Elementary School, Hurricane Sandy, different, on gun control.
Oh, Sandy Hook.
Sandy Hook. Yeah. He would like to get his gun legislation. He had family members, parents of the Sandy Hook kids. And today, Organizing for America, which is, of course, came out of his campaign to really push various areas, is having something over 100 events all over the country to get people sort of revved up to get this bill passed. Very smart to take your campaign and sort of move it into activism. What he's saying, of course, is he's not going to be talking about the assault weapons ban. He's not going to be talking about the magazine control and all that. What he is going to be talking about, or what he has talked about today, is to make sure that there are background checks for all firearm purchasers and creating new penalties on straw purchases and new funding for school security. Now, I did my little research today and found out that in the last, it's roughly about 30,000 some deaths from guns, be it suicide, homicides, accidents, and roughly about the same for car accidents. Well, you know you need to pass a driving test to drive a car in this country. Why not have some gun education?
You're singing my song. I have been saying forever that, well, not forever, but I've been saying for a while now that we should do the three things. You know, in the 1920s, we figured out that cars could kill people. That was when cars actually started killing people. You know,
right.
they were going fast enough. There were enough of them. People started dying. And so we came up with this idea of red, green, yellow lights and stop signs and standardized rules across the country. And we said three things. You've got to have a registration of that vehicle from the time it's made until the time it's destroyed. Somebody has to own it. They're responsible for it. That person has to have liability insurance, and they have to prove that they know how to drive the damn thing. We should do those three things with guns. You register the gun based on the serial number and the person who owns it from the time it's made until the time it's destroyed. Whoever owns it at any given moment has to have liability insurance. I think it's crazy that if those 20 kids at Sandy Hook had been killed by a drunk driver,
the parents would have gotten some remuneration.
The parents would have gotten $1 million from
Geico.
Well,
if you figure that 33% of American households have guns, and there's probably 75 million American households, and everybody has to pay, you know, $50 or $100 a year insurance, well, that makes a lot of money every year that could go into that kind of fund.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very straightforward. And then you know, you have to demonstrate that you know how to use them.
And who's going to insure your gun if you don't have a good record? Or if you answer on the thing, have you had a recent psychiatric hospitalization, et cetera?
And that's where trigger locks come in. Because also, you know, like you get lower health insurance rates if you don't smoke or whatever.
Right.
You know, if you drive and you don't have car accidents, you get the lower insurance rates. You could say, hey, you know, if you've got a gun safe in your house, if you use trigger locks on your guns, you know, lower liability insurance.
Exactly. So the president did that. By the way, we're also having B-52 bombers do exercise in South Korea, not North Korea. But we've been doing these for years. We just don't usually announce them. We're announcing them now. So right. We're putting North Korea on notice. Hey, guys, don't mess around.
Yeah, this is going to be a real mess if it turns into a shooting war. You know, I think I told you that
we didn't do well under Eisenhower, and we're not going to do well here.
Yeah. Louise and I saw the movie about the North Koreans taking down the White House. We saw that Sunday night. And I think Kim Jong-un saw it also. If you haven't seen that movie, it's good, dumb fun, but it's, what's it called? Something is down. Olympus is Fallen. Yeah, Olympus is Fallen is the title of the movie. If you like, you know, kind of Bruce Willis shoot 'em up type movie.
Right.
Yeah. Anyhow, thank you very much, Ellen Ratner.
Thank you.
GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Eamon Fingleton on the line with us. He's an economics journalist and contributor of Forbes.com, the author of numerous books, including one of my favorite books, In the Jaws of the Dragon. His website, Fingleton.net, and his Twitter, @Forbes. Eamon, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you so much. Are you in Europe now, or are you in Japan?
I'm in Europe. I'm in Dublin, Ireland.
Ah, okay, great. I'm curious your thoughts on what's going on in Cyprus and how this is all playing out and why.
Well, I think we're all very curious, Tom. I wrote a blog for Forbes immediately after the original news about this, saying this is inexplicable, and it's still inexplicable. I can't understand why they've been so clumsy, basically, if that is the right interpretation. There are so many unanswered questions.
Could it not be? I mean, we saw this report, I think it was in The Guardian yesterday or today, that Mario Draghi, correct my pronunciation if I have it wrong, the European Central Bank president, gave a presentation to the leaders of the European nations sometime a year or so ago, saying that there was that austerity was actually necessary and was going to work because he had two graphs, one showing wages and the other showing productivity, and he showed that the debtor countries, as it were actually had this large gap between wages and productivity that, you know, where the wages had gone up faster than productivity, and you know, that this shouldn't be, and so we need to dial them back. And it turns out that his wages numbers were not inflation adjusted, and his productivity numbers were. So it was apples and oranges. And when you inflation adjust both numbers, they were actually tracking perfectly. He was lying, but he shut down Francois Mitterrand. Mitterrand had gone to the meeting ready for a fight, and he just totally blew him up. You know, could it be that this is all just part of a plan? I mean, you know, not wanting to sound like I've got too much of a tinfoil hat on, but it doesn't seem like they would do something as large as demanding a chunk of the hide of the depositors in Cyprus without thinking it through.
It is extremely curious. As you know, a fundamental rule of banking in the post-World War II era was that small depositors were their rights were sacrosanct. And it certainly... one of the things that goes through my mind is whether the tax thing is the issue. In other words, I think that Germany, particularly the Netherlands, Finland, many of these countries in continental Europe are rather upset about the way that countries like Ireland have low tax corporate taxes and therefore get a lot of corporate investment through that route, and also a lot of banking goes through places like Ireland these days. And I think that from a German point of view, this is something of a tax ripoff, and therefore maybe there's a message here that these countries on the periphery that are being propped up now, maybe they should start thinking about obliging the Germans on the tax front, raise their corporate taxes, and stop sort of this thing of tax tourism, as they call it.
Yeah. It's interesting. This article in the Guardian says, and moreover, and this is the key point, using the correct figures. In other words, when you inflation adjust both wages and productivity, transforms Germany from the wage productivity paragon so portrayed by the central bank into what it really is: a country that has systematically undercut the stability norm for balanced growth in a monetary union, and thus been a major contributing factor to the crisis. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I unfortunately have not seen the article, but I think my understanding is that Germany is pretty productive, and I would have to take a close look at any argument that says that it isn't.
Right. No, I agree. You know, Germany is incredibly productive.
You just have to look at that country's exports to know that. That they've got a reasonably efficient economy, and then when you visit Germany, you see an economy that frankly works.
Yeah, yeah. So could this come, could Cyprus come to the United States?
I've been thinking about this. I think that I think there are two issues here. One is the big banks, and the other is the smaller banks. Ordinary banks in the United States that don't do international business, that are not up to their ears in these derivatives and so on, I think that the FDIC guarantee up to $250,000 will still obtain. It would really be an earthquake if the FDIC reneged on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the regional banks, et cetera, are relatively safe up to $250,000. These major banks that do business across international borders, they're much more of a problem for the regulators, and they have all these derivatives that are impossible to for anybody to value. So you can have shocks that suddenly emerge with these things, I think I would not have my money in some of these banks, but I think Americans generally with regional banks, probably they're okay.
Hmm. Or presumably credit unions or savings and loans?
Yeah, the smaller the bank, I think in general, probably the more secure in terms of the guarantee. The bank itself may not be solvent necessarily, but the guarantee will bail you out.
Yeah. Very interesting. Do you think that it's possible that if somebody had their money with one of the big four or the big six banks in the United States that control assets equal to two-thirds of GDP of the entire country, that if those banks were to be shaken badly, I mean, they control assets of around, what, $10, $11, $12 trillion, but their exposure to these collateralized debt obligations is tens, if not hundreds of trillions of dollars. If they got wiped out, that the government, our federal government, wouldn't at least, the FDIC wouldn't at least cover their small depositors, their first $250,000 depositors?
I think on balance, the answer to that is that the FDIC would try very hard.
Right.
The problem is that these things are such unpredictable entities that there might be an overwhelming crisis.
Yeah. You might end up taking years to try to get your money, for example.
Right. I mean, the substantive point I would make is that these derivatives should, in many cases, they should be effectively outlawed. I mean, the regulators should just clamp down on them, because in most cases, these derivatives serve no economic function. The real rationale is that the investment banks cook these things up, and they know how they work, and then they sell them to these institutional investors who don't know how they work. So the investment banks are making profits on these things, and the institutional investors are losing on them.
And what's so ironic is it was Ken Lay of Enron, you know, who was pushing for this stuff because he wanted to gamble. You know, he pushed Phil Grant. Phil Graham's wife, Wendy, was on the board of Enron. Phil Graham is the guy who did the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that allowed much of this to happen.
These things don't have an economic function. They're many of them are basically, let's say, shady.
It's the Enronization of our economy. I mean, it seems to me. Eamon Fingleton. Fingleton.net is the website, economics journalist and contributor at Forbes.com. And check out his book, The In the Jaws of the Dragon. It's a brilliant analysis of the economic and geopolitical situation. Eamon, can you stick around for a little bit?
Yes, I will. Yes.
Great. Hang on just a minute. 15 minutes past the hour.
Okay. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with a little more from Eamon Fingleton. I want to get into this whole, you know, how money works thing. Welcome back. Eamon Fingleton is with us, economics journalist, contributor of Forbes.com, the author of numerous books, including In the Jaws of the Dragon, his website, Fingleton, Fingleton.net. And Eamon, we had a caller earlier, a fellow by the name of Pete, who wanted to know what would happen if the U.S. dollar was no longer recognized worldwide as the currency of international trade, in large part because it's the currency in which oil is denominated.
Well, I think that it would happen gradually, and it will happen. It's not a question of if, but over the next 20, 30 years, the dollar will gradually be dethroned in several of its capacities as the currency of the world order. At some point, probably, you know, commodities will start being denominated in something other than dollars. It might be a basket of currencies. We don't know. But I think that if we have any faith at all in our financial masters, we have to assume that they will try to plan this so that there's no particular one day when it'll all be shockingly obvious.
Yeah. When that happens, or as that transition happens, is that going to be basically the end of American empire, or the crash of the dollar, or hyperinflation, or is that simply going to be, oh, isn't that interesting, you can buy oil in euros now?
Yeah, well, I think it will be accompanied eventually by a very drastic devaluation of the dollar. This is assuming that America doesn't get its trade position under control.
Oh, that's interesting. And what is our trade position right now?
Well, the current account deficit, which is the widest and most meaningful measure of American trade, runs between 4 and 6% of GDP, which is an absolutely huge number. It's particularly huge when you remember that manufacturing is now down to 11% of GDP, and services, hardly export, most services have to be performed within the country, and those services that do export tend to be weak in exporting. So you're relying on your for your exports on a manufacturing sector down to 11% of the economy, and you've got this huge gaping hole in the trade, 5% typically of GDP. Of a deficit. How do you close that gap? The problem is now an epochal one. It's just there seems to me no way out. America's on the skids.
Wow. Well, couldn't we just kind of wake up one day and say, you know, let's go back to having tariffs, or let's do a VAT tax and have a functional tariff, you know, that we can reverse out on exports and we can double down on imports the way Germany does?
A very good the first move would be to bring in value-added tax, as you suggest. That would be number one, and it would be perfectly in line with trade treaties and all the rest of it, so there would be no problem doing that. I think longer term, or maybe it should be in the short term, the U.S. should be looking at tariffs, because free trade is not working for the United States. That's obvious. You look at all these factories. I often travel from New York to Washington and all through New Jersey and Pennsylvania. All these factories just rotting hulks. It should be obvious to everybody that there's something wrong.
Yeah, it's like a giant sign. I mean, you go past miles and miles, and not just the factories, the miles and miles of row houses that were once filled with the people who worked in the factories, and now they look like Dresden. You know, they're just these bombed out hulks.
Absolutely, yeah.
As a reporter, are you seeing any evidence of a move toward a protectionist trade policy in the United States? It seems to me like not only are we not doing that, but we've got a president who's talking about, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, about expanding free trade rather than restraining it.
You're right. It is amazing that virtually nobody in Washington seems to get it. I think in the country as a whole in the United States, people have always been skeptical of free trade, and I think probably even more now than ever. But a majority, certainly, if you had a referendum, would be against free trade, would be against this Trans-Pacific Partnership.
And yet the big corporations, the big transnational corporations, they see this as a way to radically increase their profits, expand their markets. They don't care that it's hurting the United States. Other countries have been smart enough to put into place VAT taxes or maintain tariffs or other trade restrictions. You know, there's a whole variety of them. I mean, you wrote the book on it. What's made America so stupid?
I think it's a failure of American democracy, perhaps. I'm actually writing a book on this at the moment, and it's a history of American decline. Looking back over the last 40, 50 years, basically since I went to college in 1965, which seems to me to have been the absolute zenith for the American way of life. It's been downhill all the way since then. And nobody's taking responsibility, almost nobody. The press is not taking responsibility. The politicians are not taking responsibility. The politicians are just touting for contributions, and they will do whatever the contributors ask them to do. So it goes round in a circle.
Aren't there some incredible parallels between that and the Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover administrations? I mean, Warren Harding came into office in 1921 on the slogan of more business in government, less government in business, and he immediately dropped the top income tax rate from 90% down to 25%.
Right, yeah. Certainly, all this talk about taxes is completely irrelevant. You can have a very successful economy with high tax rates, there's no correlation between tax rates and the success of an economy. As you know, an economy like Sweden is very successful. Mm-hmm. Tax rates there are high and always have been.
Yeah. Eamon Fingleton. Eamon, it's always a pleasure, and it's always illuminating talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Eamon Fingleton, economics journalist and contributor at Forbes.com. Check out his book, In the Jaws of the Dragon, and his website, Fingleton.net. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, trade deficits. How do we address this? How do we get this on the radar of Americans, of the political parties? Good, the bad, and the very, very amadelphously ugly. The good. Panera Bread. This week, the gourmet sandwich chain started a bold experiment in socially conscious capitalism. On Wednesday, all Panera locations in the company's home city of St. Louis, Missouri, began offering what they called meals of shared responsibility. The idea is simple. All Gateway City cafes will provide an organic turkey chili in a bread bowl at pay-what-you-want prices. Panera's executives are encouraging wealthier customers to pay a higher price for the meal so that poorer customers, especially St. Louis's homeless population, can enjoy and afford a tasty turkey chili. If the trial run is successful, the company will start offering meals of shared responsibility at locations all across the country. Who knew doing the right thing could be so delicious? The bad. The Kentucky legislature. The Bluegrass State took a step backwards Tuesday when it overrode Governor Steve Beshear's veto of House Bill 279. According to its proponents, HB 279, the so-called Religious Freedom Bill, will protect the state's citizens from government trampling on their beliefs. The bill's critics, however, argue that the law's language is overly vague and gives businesses an excuse to discriminate against LGBT Kentuckians as well as other disenfranchised groups. Although Governor Beshear's veto message specifically called out the law's more problematic language, both Democrats and Republicans went ahead and passed the full bill anyway. For Kentucky lawmakers, it appears bigotry knows no party line. And the very, very ugly Glenn Beck. What a surprise, huh? The right-wing talk show host sparked another controversy this week when he argued that a fifth column of Islamist Somali immigrants is behind the Congressional Ethics Committee's probe of Michelle Bachmann.
You see what they're doing to Michelle Bachmann? Michelle Bachmann is under all kinds of ethics investigations now. Why do you suppose that is? Do you know one of her districts?
Lakes.
Yeah. Do you know one of her districts is being settled by the State Department? You know the State Department just takes Somalis and just says, oh, by the way, all you guys from Somalia, you're going to go over here, and we're just going to develop a community for you here. In her district. And the State Department is just pushing them all into Minnesota. So she has asked the questions, why? Why is my district? How did that even happen? Why was my district selected for this?
Has she gotten any answers?
No, she hadn't gotten any answers, and now she's under investigation.
I think it's safe to say that when you make even Michelle Bachmann look sane, whatever you're arguing is just very, very ugly. Very strange. Well, maybe the State Department is engaged in a huge conspiracy to put black people from Africa in Michelle Bachmann's district. And, I mean, that's the subtext, right? It's got to be the subtext. Connie in Freeland, Michigan. Hey, Connie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about austerity because people keep calling into your show comparing government to a family and claiming that a family whose expenses are greater than their income would cut back, so government should too.
Right.
But they're assuming that it's a family without assets. A government is more like a family with assets because we've got buildings and parks and things like that. And a family with assets and a cash flow problem would borrow against those assets, put that borrowed money somewhere where they have a potential to have revenue down the road, like maybe putting in an apartment in their basement or starting a new business.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that government, like a family with assets, should be borrowing and investing in future income.
I agree.
Like,
I absolutely agree.
So I wanted to call and say that.
Well, you said it very well, and Connie, and I would add, let me put an even finer point on it, that if you look at the history of what families have actually done in the United States since the Reagan Revolution, you know, when Ronald Reagan came into office, the majority of families in the United States were single wage earner families. Now we're nearly two. And what families have done in response to Reaganomics, where we've seen individual workers' wages actually go down over the last 30 years, family income has remained steady because families have worked harder and they've generated additional income. And it's, you know, it's gone up in uninflation adjusted numbers, but in inflation adjusted numbers, it's held the same. But basically how families have responded to Reaganomics, to austerity, to a diminished lifestyle is by working harder and trying to earn more money. And many families have earned more money and said, okay, you know, this is how we'll respond to it, or we'll at least, you know, we'll, and so that's another thing, you know, is that would be the equivalent of government raising taxes and saying, you know, we need to increase our revenue. We don't just stop eating. We increase revenues, which would be raising taxes. So, Connie, thank you for raising that. I appreciate it. That very, very nice. Bill in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, Bill, you want to talk about fractional reserve banking, eh?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, your last caller just talked about how if you built an apartment in the basement or did an asset.
Right.
But the interesting, we've broken the system of wealth redistribution in the world. Wages used to redistribute it. Taxes used to redistribute it. Mm-hmm. But instead now what we've allowed to happen is the banks were redistributing it through debt. And bank debt, when you and I borrow it, is real. We have to come up with the interest. We have to earn that extra money to pay it back.
Yeah.
The government, on the other hand, doesn't really, because they print the money, at least in our case.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to actually take the fictitious money that we've created in the system, which is, you know, fractional reserve or even federal reserve, because who's to say there's real money backing every dollar the U.S. government prints?
Right.
You know, if we did an audit, I doubt.
Well, there is no such thing as real money. All real money. I mean, you take your choice. It's one or the other, but it's fiat money. So there's nothing that backs our money beyond the wealth and confidence in the United States of America.
Right, but it's not even the wealth, because it's the production, the future potential. Because
arguably, I mean, the country though does have assets. Our families in the United States are sitting on $46 trillion worth of assets.
Well, but that's fictional assets. It's only there because we put a value on a dollar and say that's what they have.
Well, but people have houses and land and.
Oh, no, right. No, that's real assets.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. If you add up and if you add that up along with what, you know, what people have invested, it's $46 trillion. I mean, we are incredibly rich as a country. Okay.
Okay, so let's say as an example, I have a customer who's owed me $100 for the last 2 years. Right. And if all they did was continue to do business with me and never paid me back, I would not be an unhappy person.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I need is income now, not income from the past.
Right, even though you are basically subsidizing them to the tune of 2 or 3% a year, $2 or $3 a year against that 100,
right,
which is what you could earn if you had taken that $100 and thrown it into a T-bill.
Exactly. But so if we basically forgave all fictional or fractional debt, let's say, the only people getting hurt are the people who own the banks.
Who would make the interest, yes.
Who would make the interest. And in reality, all they're making is the interest, because that other money is sort of, you know, printed money. It's fictional money.
You know, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, for an example, I have assets, but I probably have liabilities to the bank exceeding my assets by a small amount. There are some people who have absolutely no assets, you know, who owe money, who would come off, you know, at least they'd be net zero.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if they could go out tomorrow and work, they'd be better off than they are today. I'd be no worse off than I am today. And maybe Mitt Romney, instead of dying with $200 million, may die with, I don't know, say $50 million in the bank?
Yeah, I think he's probably closer to $800 million to a billion right now. But, yeah, point taken. And in fact, to put an even finer point on this, the Quran forbids the charging of interest. And so in Muslim countries that are operating under Muslim law, you know, Muslim slash whatever law, the banking systems don't charge interest. They don't do fractional reserve banking. Instead, they do fee-based banking. So, which is much like what the Swiss do, oddly enough. When I lived in Germany, I tried to open a Swiss bank account and discovered to my horror that if I put my money in the Swiss bank, I had to pay them every month to keep my money, rather than getting interest on the money. And it can be quite expensive, by the way.
Well, but what we've done, too, by allowing 30% interest rates and 7% mortgage rates and things of that nature is we found another way to redistribute money from working people to the rich.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is, arguably, Judaism and Christianity both also, forbid the charging of interest. It's called usury. We converted that in our minds into excessive interest. And up until the Nixon administration, it was illegal in the United States for anybody to charge anybody over 10%. And now you've got payday lenders that are charging 400-500% a year.
But at least they're charging on real money, not fractional money. Banks are charging it on fractional money.
Yeah, I'm with you. Bill Shano says that you are the guy who wins a copy of the Tom Hartman Reader today, autographed by the author and sent to you by stamps.com. So I'm going to put you on hold. Bill is on line one. Tell Danielle. And she will get your address and we'll send you off an autographed book, assuming you'd like one. The Tom Hartman Reader, edited by Ty Moses and published by Barrett Kohler, sent to you by stamps.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
We have the smartest listeners on earth. And Shano appreciates that. Keeps him intellectually stimulated. So, good on you, Bill. Welcome back. Fair and only slightly unbalanced, the Tom Hartman Program. Malcolm in Park Forest, Illinois. Listening on WCPT. Hey, Malcolm, what's up?
At last. How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing well. I hope you are, too.
Okay. You had an earlier guest, I won't call his name, that was talking about a movement to counteract what the right-wing conservatives are doing.
Yeah, Mike Pelton.
Well, if all you have to do is look and see who's in the White House, and you'll see the result of a progressive movement. When people like myself listen to you and Ed Schultz and other progressives, and you give us these numbers to contact our senator or our representative in Washington. We call, put pressure on them, write letters and emails, and then go to the polls and reelect the first black president in the United States. That's one of the greatest movements in political history of the United States.
You know, you're right. We're not giving ourselves enough credit, Malcolm.
That is a movement. So we don't need, some people. I mean, a lot of times...
We don't need to be crying in our beer here.
That's right. A lot of times the messenger can discredit himself by being so patronizing with people. What did Jesus say? Don't worry about the speck in somebody else's eye. Look at the mote in your eye.
Yeah, the beam in your eye.
One of your guests needs to think about that. Okay?
Yeah,
and
there you go.
I just want to say that look who's in the White House, and you'll see the results of a great progressive movement. I listen to your show. I buy the products that you advertise. I've told at least 30 people to listen to this radio station, to you.
That is great.
And Goldman and Schultz and everybody. Educated people, officials in universities and things. So people like me, we do our part. We are the movement. So we don't need some figurehead, as part of them telling us what to do. We're intelligent enough, organized enough. And Barack Obama is a political genius because he knows one thing. He goes directly to the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what he's doing now with Organizing for America. Yeah.
So it's wonderful to see the Republican, the right wing, destroying themselves and becoming extinct like the dinosaurs.
Yeah, well, from your lips to God's ears, Malcolm. We'll see. I think that America is coming very, very close to some kind of a major turning point where we either get far more progressive and go deeper into New Deal and Great Society ideals and become more like the Northern European countries, or where we become very conservative and we move in the direction of Pinochet's Chile, following the teachings of Milton Friedman. And there's a large right-wing movement that wants to take us in that latter direction, and it scares the hell out of me. But but you're right. You know, having elected the first African American president of the United States, that is a major accomplishment in President Obama. Spot on. Thanks a lot, Malcolm. Thanks for the call. Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM. Hey, Kirk, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to disagree with Paps. You know, about 14 years ago, we saw an incredible confluence of environmentalists, labor people, NGOs, faith organizations, and even the more enlightened members of the Democratic Party when we all came together in Seattle to protest WTO. I have just a beautiful memory of Paul Wellstone and Sherrod Brown, particularly Paul Wellstone, giving us this amazing fire them up speech before we went out and marched that morning, and it was at 6 o'clock in our union hall.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but we have WTO now.
Yeah, it's still there, and I think the problem, you know, this sort of resurfaced with Occupy, but at the time of WTO, everybody came together, and it sort of moved on from WTO into the Nader 2000 campaign. Mm. But that was at the end of an economic boom. There wasn't an economic crisis that coincided with that organizing for WTO. If those two things would have come together at the same time,
yeah,
I think that we would have had an incredible revolution.
Well, that's what I think is going to happen. I think that then the next time that there is a serious economic crisis, and it's coming, that out of that, out of those ashes, is going to rise the phoenix of the true American values, of an America that cares for each, you know, where we take care of our own. And you know, we will go back to a rational trade policy, and we will stop listening to transnational corporations and transnational billionaires who are trying to tell us that you need to make your government smaller so that we can take up more space here. Kirk, thank you for the call. Thanks for your comments. John in Roseville, Michigan. Hey, John, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Tom, thanks for your endurance. I don't know how you do it every day.
I'm having a good time.
I'm glad. You're one of the few out there that has the voice. My situation here in Michigan, I'm retired from General Motors, and today we became a right-to-work state officially today.
Today was the day the law went into effect. Wow. So you're a right-to-work-for-less state.
Right. And today, Snyder, somebody asked him, well, when are these companies going to move into Michigan and create these new jobs? He says, well, it's going to take some time. It may take 5 to 10 years.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Well, it'll take 5 to 10 years for the standard of living in Michigan to drop to the point where you know, companies will come in and start offering, you know, $7.25 an hour wages, and you don't have the right to unionize anymore.
Right. I just wanted to let you know that here in southeastern Michigan, if President Obama had and the Democrats had not given those loans to General Motors and Chrysler, Michigan right now would basically be in a depression.
Oh, it would be a waste.
Any
kind
of
waste.
There are no jobs.
Yeah.
And there are still foreclosures occurring all
sure.
over the place, and we have empty factories all over southeastern Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
I know. I get back there at least once a year to visit family, and I'm quite familiar with what you're talking about. And this, you know, this is I've been saying this for a long, long time. John, thank you for the call. This is the predictable consequence of, you know, 30 some odd years or 32 years of Reaganomics. It's like just, you know, combined with the insanity of free trade. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here talking about the important issues of the week and answering your questions. Plus, anything goes on Anything Goes Friday. Get the topics, and we'll riff on them. And the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.